Hey, everybody. Thanks for picking up another episode of On Science, the weekly podcast from the Science Desk at NPR News. I'm Andrew Prince. This week, we'll continue with some coverage from Japan, but we'll also turn to the home front. We'll hear how the nuclear accident in the country has put a renewed focus on spent nuclear fuel in the U.S. And we'll talk to engineers to try to answer the question, how safe is safe enough? And at the end of the podcast, we'll take a trip from northern Japan to Tokyo to San Francisco and follow food along the way. But first, the earthquake that struck Japan several weeks ago will be remembered mainly for the devastating tsunami that it created. The quake itself did remarkably little damage to buildings in most areas, thanks to strict construction codes. But in a few places, particularly around Tokyo, buildings didn't fare so well. As NPR's John Hamilton reports, these are places built on land reclaimed from the sea.
When the ground began to shake at Shoppers Plaza near Tokyo, people got outside in a hurry. A video shows them milling about on a paved courtyard, waiting for the aftershocks to end. Then, sections of the courtyard begin to pulse and heave. The pavement buckles, black liquid flows up through the cracks. Teiko Kato was there. She had just run out of the flower shop she manages, carrying the store's most valuable orchid.
I really witnessed when the ground was moving in sideways, and we thought that we cannot stand up there, so we moved farther down to closer to that bus stop.
Within minutes, mud covered much of the courtyard. In places, the ground level dropped as much as a foot. Out on the street, manholes were being pushed up out of the earth. Water pipes broke. Utility poles began to lean.
怖そうですね。怖いです。この柱が
Kato says she was terrified because she knew what was going on. It was more than an earthquake. The ground beneath her had become liquid. It's called liquefaction. The shaking allows sand and water underground to rise and things on the surface to sink. Kato's shop and everything around it is built on land that used to be part of Tokyo Bay. And this sort of reclaimed land is vulnerable to liquefaction. But it's also cheaper to live here. So Kato and her family had moved in despite the risk.
We came in with a dream to have a new shining life in a nice area. But I don't know after experiencing this.
Since the earthquake, a lot of engineers have been visiting this area called Ureyasu to figure out precisely what happened. Ross Boulanger spent several days there before returning to his job at the University of California, Davis. He says what happened is like what happens when you mix beach sand and water in a pail and shake it.
Soil takes on the appearance of being like a liquid, and that's where the term liquefaction comes from.
Boulanger has studied liquefaction from the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake in California. It affected San Francisco's Marina District, which is also built on reclaimed land. But Boulanger says what he saw near Tokyo Bay was much worse. That's because the Japanese earthquake was more powerful and went on for a very long time.
You know, if you look at, by comparison, the motions in the Marina District from the Loma Prieta earthquake, strong shaking was over in 10 or 15 seconds, whereas at some of these sites, the shaking is going on for minutes.
Boulanger says that may be the reason even small houses in Ureyasu were damaged. Usually these houses are so light they tend to float even as the ground liquefies.
You know, one of the things we'd never really seen before were very light structures settling and tilting by amounts we hadn't really seen in other earthquakes.
Takako Utsunomiya lives in one of those structures. It's a two-story home in a nice part of Ureyasu, not far from Tokyo Disneyland. Utsunomiya is sweeping the path from her front door as two masked workers shovel mud from a walkway beside the house. The house is still intact on its concrete slab foundation, but you might not want to live in it.
My house
was heavily damaged because it's really tilted and distorted toward the backside of the land. And if you're standing in a house, you feel dizzy because it's the floor is distorted.
Engineers say there was much less damage at nearby Tokyo Disneyland, which is also built on reclaimed land. They say that's because Disney spent a lot of money to pack down the reclaimed land before building their theme park on it. John Hamilton, NPR News.
The nuclear accident in Japan has rekindled debate about what to do with used reactor fuel. The Japanese power plant housed tons of highly radioactive used fuel in pools filled with water. There are similar pools at more than 60 reactor sites in the U.S., so there's renewed interest in their safety. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
The uranium fuel in the core of a nuclear reactor creates heat and power for about 5 to 10 years. Plant operators then transfer the used fuel rods, which are still hot and radioactive, to a nearby pool. In Japan, the pool lost cooling water. The fuel overheated and was probably damaged. The event highlights the fact that the U.S. has lots of used fuel in similar pools, waiting to be disposed of in a permanent repository. Here's Ernest Moniz, a physicist at MIT, at a Senate hearing on the Japanese accident.
I would say the storage of spent fuel between, if you like, the reactor and the presumed repository has been an afterthought. It has not really been part of a serious policy discussion about fuel cycle design.
The presumed repository was Yucca Mountain, a complex of underground tunnels in Nevada that was decades in the making. The Obama administration has decided not to use the site. During the long debate on Yucca Mountain, power companies continued to put more fuel rods in pools. Once they cool off, 5 to 10 years, they go into concrete and steel casks and are stored at the reactor sites. Gregory Yatsko, chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, told the Senate this stopgap system isn't perfect, but it works.
Right now, we believe that for at least 100 years, that fuel can be stored with very little impacts to health and safety.
Most nuclear critics say the casks work well, but the pools remain a weak link. Former nuclear engineer David Lochbaum is with the Union of Concerned Scientists.
At all U.S. reactors, the spent fuel pool is housed in less robust containment than surrounds the reactor core. More radiated fuel that is less well protected and less well defended is an undue hazard.
For example, spent fuel pools are not generally housed inside concrete containment buildings, as reactors are. They're inside an ordinary building. And as used fuel accumulates, reactor operators have had to pack the rods closer together in the pools, which requires even more cooling. At Xcel Energy, Nuclear Affairs Chief Terry Pickens says reactor operators had to do this because the federal government failed to keep a promise it made to power companies long ago to take their old fuel by 1998.
We were able to get it where we thought we could make it to 1998, and then they still aren't performing, and now we still want to refuel and operate our reactors, so we have to make more space in the pools.
Pickens and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission say the pools and casks are safe, but it takes a lot of juggling to cycle the fuel rods through the pools and into the casks at the right time, and it's an expense that electricity consumers are paying for. James Konka, a geophysicist at the Hanford nuclear site in Washington State, says the government needs to change the status quo.
Come up with a strategy for how you go forward, because you really can't go forward with nuclear anything unless you make this decision. Where are you going to put your waste away from the environment, away from humans?
The White House has appointed a panel of experts to do that, to find a place to put used reactor fuel as well as old bomb-making waste. Konka has testified before that panel and argues that salt deposits are the best place for a permanent dump site. Currently, the government operates the country's only underground nuclear repository in salt deposits in Carlsbad, New Mexico. The panel spent several days visiting the site earlier this year. They're set to make their preliminary recommendation in July. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Whether it's a nuclear power plant, or a bridge, or an airplane, engineers have to design things to certain specifications. And they have to grapple with the question of how safe is safe enough. NPR's Joe Palka has been talking with engineers about that question.
When humans first started building things, determining whether they would work as planned was mostly a matter of trial and error. Build a bridge, drive a chariot across it, and see if the bridge collapsed.
And it really wasn't until the Renaissance, until Galileo, that there was what we would today call a rational approach to design through calculation.
Henry Petrosky is a professor of engineering at Duke University. He says now computers and mathematical models can predict how a bridge will behave under different conditions. But Petrosky says if you ask engineers to build a safe bridge or a safe nuclear plant, they ask you what you mean by that.
The definition of safe is not strictly an engineering term, it's a societal term. Does it mean absolutely no loss of life? Does it mean absolutely no contamination by radiation? What exactly does safe mean?
Once you settle that question, engineers still face the problem of deciding how to achieve whatever level of safety they're aiming for. Michael Corradini is a professor of nuclear engineering at the University of Wisconsin. He says first, you design for normal operating conditions.
And then with any engineering design, anything at all, you then say, okay, well, that's fine, that's what it operates on, but what if something happens that it doesn't experience some unusual conditions?
So, for example, let's say you're designing a bridge for a place where gale force winds and heavy snows are virtually unheard of.
But you still design for it so that the bridge safely performs its function, or if it fails, it fails gently, so there's no catastrophic effects.
In other words, the bridge doesn't collapse. Wind and snow are one thing, but what about other kinds of safety threats? How well will a bridge do if terrorists try to blow it up? What happens if operators in a nuclear plant control room suddenly get sick? What if a meteorite falls on the plant? Corradini says nuclear power plant designers try to think of everything.
They have a listing of all the things that they think can go wrong and how they can go wrong and some sort of ordered list of which is more likely than others.
And don't think I'm joking about the possibility of a meteorite falling on the plant.
It's there somewhere. It's just a very low probability.
But sometimes when you set out to build a nuclear power plant, you don't know exactly what the likelihood of a particular calamity might be.
When we plan something, always we make an assumption.
Yotaro Hatamura is an emeritus professor of engineering at the University of Tokyo. He says engineers sometimes don't pay enough attention to history in making their assumptions. He favors what he calls backward thinking. The reactor core might survive an earthquake, but what about the pumps that provide cooling water to the reactor? Or what about the backup generators that provide emergency power to the pumps? Or what about the fuel supply for the emergency generators? He says accidents happen when engineers don't constantly test and revise the assumptions they've made about all the things that a nuclear plant needs to operate.
We can avoid these accidents by thinking way, backward thinking.
And backward thinking is to say, look at the previous step,
yes,
see if that worked properly,
yes,
and if it didn't, change it so that you go forward with a better path.
Yes.
Hatamura says it's not always easy to look back and admit to problems that you should have thought of in the first place. We don't see what we don't want to see, Hatamura says. We don't want to think about scary things. That's just human nature. Joe Palca, NPR News, Tokyo.
Radiation levels in seawater and soil samples from near Japan's Fukushima nuclear complex have raised concerns about food safety. Japan has restricted food shipments from the four prefectures or states nearest the plant. Other countries, including the U.S., have stopped imports from those areas. In many cases, though, the public fears seem to outstrip legitimate concerns. Over the next few minutes, our reporters track the seafood scare, from a Japanese sea farmer to a San Francisco sushi chef. We start with NPR's John Burnett on the coast of northeastern Japan.
They say the world's best green seaweed, which is not an oxymoron, comes from here on Japan's Pacific coast, where just the right temperature, salinity, and nutrients produce Sanriku wakame. That's the seaweed you see floating in a bowl of miso soup. But Japanese seaweed farmers along the coast are in a world of hurt these days, their livelihoods washed away by the tsunami, and now the reputation of their products threatened by nuclear jitters. Mitsue Murakami is a seaweed scallops and oyster sea farmer on the island of Oshima, known as the Green Pearl for its lush pine-covered hills. It lies just off the coastal city of Kesenuma, about 90 miles north of the stricken nuclear reactors.
We have to live day by day. We won't know for years how much radiation exposure people receive. The thing I'm worried about today is if people stop buying our seaweed and scallops because they're afraid of radiation.
The tsunami wiped out the fishing fleet of Oshima. The boats are scattered helter-skelter on land, their nets tangled in tall bamboo. The surge of water also took away Murakami's 10-room inn with its picture postcard vista of the fishing harbor. Thankfully, her family survived. Murakami had a large batch of seaweed drying behind her house that was 2 days away from shipping to the buyer. The sea reclaimed it. Everything was lost, she says with a gentle smile. Murakami walks around the cement foundation, which is all that's left of her inn, the Big Ocean Hotel. The sea is cruel, but it's also generous. They're doubtful they will rebuild the hotel, but she will return to her family's sea farming grounds a mile offshore and grow more wakame seaweed and scallops.
We won't be defeated by this, and we're trying very hard to overcome this hardship. I will be very grateful if everyone will enjoy Japanese seafood again, as before.
From Green Pearl Island, I'm John Burnett.
I'm John Hamilton in Tokyo. Every day, hundreds of tons of fish and seaweed are bought and sold at the city's seafood markets. The markets are still bustling, despite the troubles in Fukushima, but prices have fallen sharply. People are afraid these products might be contaminated with radioactive material. To find out how likely that is, I went to see someone who should know.
My name is Masashi Kusakabe.
Dr. Kusakabe directs the Nakaminato Laboratory for Marine Radioecology, not far from Tokyo. It's a research center devoted to figuring out precisely what happens to radioactive stuff that gets into the ocean. Dr. Kusakabe says what's been getting into the Pacific Ocean near Fukushima is mostly radioactive iodine. It dissolves in water, and experiments have shown that the iodine tends to concentrate in algae. Then it gets even more concentrated as it works its way up the food chain. Dr. Kusakabe says that might sound bad.
But the iodine we're talking about now is iodine 131, which has a very short half-life, at 8 days.
Every 8 days, half of it goes away. So after a few weeks, there's not much iodine 131 left in a fish. Kusakabe says radioactive cesium is a lot worse. Its half-life is measured in decades, not days. But so far, much less cesium has gotten into the ocean at Fukushima. Also, the ocean is so vast that radioactive materials are heavily diluted by the time they travel even a few miles. So the Japanese fish most likely to become contaminated are the ones that spend their entire lives right near the Fukushima power plant. And the government isn't letting fishing vessels anywhere near the place. But what about the ocean-going fish that show up on sashimi platters, fish like salmon and tuna? I asked Dr. Kusakabe whether they might be contaminated by radioactive material from the power plant.
I don't think so, because tuna move everywhere. They travel, you know, maybe hundreds of kilometers, so they never stay there.
A tuna might swim by the Fukushima plant, but it wouldn't hang around long enough to become seriously contaminated. Dr. Kusakabe says the biggest threat to the Japanese fishing industry right now isn't radiation, it's fear.
Most people now think, oh, it's very dangerous to eat fish in Japan or fish around this coast. But I think it's very safe. So now it's a chance to eat fish because it's cheap.
You're still eating fish?
Oh, of course. Why not?
Dr. Kusakabe says once people realize Japanese fish are safe, he expects the price of Pacific bluefin to go back up. John Hamilton, NPR News, Tokyo.
I'm Richard Gonzalez in Oakland. For many people in this region, the word sushi is synonymous with Yoshi's. It's a Japanese restaurant and jazz club with venues here and in San Francisco. Sho Kamio is the executive chef for both restaurants. He also grew up in Sendai, where his parents survived the earthquake and tsunami.
I'm really, really disappointed. I'm very shocked still.
Kamio says as a result of the nuclear crisis, he's had a few customers ask about the safety of his fish supply. He tells them that 96% of the sushi he serves comes from fish drawn from domestic waters, the rest from the global market.
I'm pretty sure, 100% pretty sure, everything okay, fine.
Operators of sushi bars and restaurants around the Bay Area that once relied on the Japanese market also say they've gone to lengths to find other sources for fish. They've had no choice. Michael Gallion is a general manager of Morimoto Napa.
The Japanese Prime Ministry has strict controls on all the exported product going out of Japan right now, as well as the FDA has strict controls on this side of all imports coming in. And while we do source some fish from Japan, the fish we source is far from the site. So we feel very confident that what we're serving is completely safe.
Outside of another sushi bar, Mijori, in Oakland, patrons said they aren't worried. Kayla Kirsch is a nonprofit consultant.
I have concerns about the radiation in Japan, but I don't have concerns about eating sushi in Oakland, California. Most of the fish is local, I assume, and not imported.
They had a long way to swim if they were in my supper tonight.
Loretta Eskenazi is a retired painter. She's just consumed a plate of tuna sashimi and a California roll. Eskenazi says she can't imagine any company skirting import controls to sell contaminated fish. It's just bad for business, she says.
You know, it's like nobody picks apples off the ground and sells those, and that's what they'll be.
Even so, an association of local Japanese restaurant owners is concerned that the nuclear crisis could keep customers away. So it's laying plans for a PR offensive, if it's needed, to assure consumers that their products are safe. Richard Gonzalez, NPR News, Oakland.
And that's the On Science podcast from NPR News. I'm Andrew Prince. We've got more next week.